by the way, for those of you that have bought the book and you would like us to sign it, we'd be glad to stay after and sign the book if you'd like.
Okay, our understanding is we have about a half hour just for open discussion. So, I guess we're kind of looking to you for the lead. Yes?
I was going to ask for a share of any of your voice when somebody's dying. You know, you think you'd read, oh, what should it be, you or should it be me, you know? This kind of thing. If it seems it's really bad, you just feel so humiliated that you even said what you said, you know? Oh, you remember my son was dying. He was already had been told he had Hodgkin's disease. And I was by the stove cooking something, and he said, Mother, what do I have? And I said, didn't the doctor tell you? He said, well, he said something, but I didn't understand it. I said, you know, it was cancer. So it was just real. He kind of swallowed it. It was just, you know, he was just terrified when he heard that word. And I heroically said, oh, Nico, I wish I would have it instead of you. And later, by the time I took him to City of Hope, you know, by this time he was getting morphine. And as I go in to take him, and I knew I had to leave him there, I was so frightened because he was asking for the medicine, and I could tell it, the things that the words that I had said came back to me. I was just terrified of him saying, you know, I wish I had it instead of you. I got out of the room, you know, because I started to cry and I didn't want him to see him. So the nurse came over and consoled me. But like I said, you do heroics like that at times, you know. Mm-hmm. I should have it, you know. Mm-hmm. Don't ever wish for anything God will give you. So that was my experience.
Yeah, that's interesting. When my son died, I didn't have to go through that initial pain of him having cancer or whatever. I was telling Gloria that my grandson just got into an accident that very well could have been fatal on Saturday. And his clavicle was broke, his jaw was broke, his lung was collapsed, and he's going to be fine. But, you know, that was a real scare. For me, it was more just going through the day-to-day living and dealing with the emotions. And I had a father my father died of pancreatic cancer, so I went through that capacity, and same with my grandmother. She had a terminal illness beforehand. But the day-to-day emotions and having compassion for yourself and realizing that so much of the time you're human and you're going through whatever it is that you're going through. In the book, I remember one of the things that I was writing was I came back from my brother's funeral. My brother also died in a motorcycle accident. I came back from the funeral, and my sister-in-law was talking of a derogatory about my mother, and I was so angry that I was so enraged. It was really surprising to me. I left my body, and it was like I was looking down on my body as a witness, you know, and curious, you know, as to this raging woman, you know. And you know, it was really interesting to see that. And afterwards, to go to my sister-in-law and apologize and to realize that it had to do with my own grief that was so wanting to come out, and to have compassion for myself. To have compassion, you know, it's just the day-to-day people that are angry at you, or your own anger. Look at it and have compassion. Try to understand where people are coming from. We're all human. We're all in this together.
And having said that about having compassion on myself, at that time I had quit my job at Ojai Valley Inn, and I was in Los Angeles with some friends. And I went home. I was coming from getting in Los Angeles, you know, all the traffic and finding from one place to the other. I got lost, and it was a hot day. I got to the house, and I knew nobody was there. They had gone to another dwelling that we had far away. And I went to the cupboard, and I knew where they kept the liquor. So I got quite drunk. They had a big crucifix, a bronze crucifix, I remember it. And I sat in there and I said, what do you think you've done to me?
What are you
thinking? I said, wait, you know, the answer comes, look at me, I'm on the cross.
May I share that when you first spoke, the first thing I thought, unless I misunderstood you, is what a loving thing to say. I wish I had it instead of you.
Yeah, but so, you need it. When the time comes, when I knew that he was so desperate because he was so fearful of my meeting him there, you know, that was the last straw. And just think, oh my God! And I remember what I had said. I said, I don't want it any more than what he's got. You know?
Just recently I've been hearing and talking about change agent. Somebody who comes in to bring change and thinks they're doing so much good really reminded me when I first started working with the blind. The referrals came from Social Security and Welfare. Go out and see this person. I was so enthused. Oh boy, I'm going to show you cane travel. I'm going to show you how to cook. And maybe you can learn Braille. Mm-hmm. And they're just saying, get the hell out of here. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to see you. It took me a long time.
They weren't ready.
No. And I didn't respect their grief. You know, I was going to change it, whether they liked it or not. And that whole thing about, it took me a long time to accept that people are going to sit in their misery for a long time, sometimes, till they're ready to move. Mm-hmm. And I can't shove them out.
Right.
That doesn't work.
And it's humbling, isn't it?
Oh, isn't it? Yeah. Yes. But I had all this stuff to give them.
And you still do.
When they're ready.
When they're ready in God's time, not in our... Even if our intentions are good, when we get lost in what we think should happen. Yeah.
That's beautiful. And the realization that, you know, we all go through that grief when something traumatic happens in our lives, and, you know, a loss that we're attached to, and to realize that, you know, when somebody else is going through that same situation, not to rush into too fast, because, you know, we don't like it when people are in denial. We don't like it when people are angry. We don't like it when people are depressed. And not to push them through it, but gently remind them and give them a helping hand.
Yeah. If I may say that another way, how often, it happens in so many different ways, but you've probably all heard this. You might have even said it to someone else. You got to get on with your life. You have to stop crying.
Yes.
Yeah.
And to me, that says a lot about the person who's saying it, not about the person who's grieving. Because grief is a process the person has to go through. We encourage people to cry. And remind them that everything changes, there will be an end. But right now, that's the truth. So when someone may say that to you, we encourage folks to just say, well, I see you're uncomfortable with the fact that I'm grieving, but this is what's true for me, and I can't stop crying, and if you're uncomfortable, you'll just have to leave. I don't know how odd that may sound.
Yeah.
And realize that we, unfortunately, when we're in grief, we have to educate others. And otherwise, we're going to lose all our friends.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Susan.
Just on that, I was going to say that when after we lost our house in the fire, the Painted Cave fire in 1990, one of my neighbors was in real deep grief over the loss of all of her things in a large house. Mm-hmm. And I was just the opposite. Actually, I've been praying for a simpler life for years before.
One person's hell is another person's hell.
It was actually quite, I floated for about 3 months realizing how much I had let go of my material possessions. And I mean, nobody in our family was hurt. But she was calling me every day, and I reached a point where I realized she wasn't good for me, and I wasn't good for her, because she was dragging me down. I had really let go, and I was taking it all too casually. So we had a common friend that I knew could really help her be where she was. And so this person actually kind of took over and accompanied her through that process. But I ran into her over a year later, and she still was in the middle of the grief, and people were saying to her exactly what you said, Ron, you've got to get over this. That was over a year ago. And I said to her, you know, don't let anybody tell you how long you need to take a grief. You grieve until, you know, it feels good to live.
If I may, what is the person, or
did you turn it on?
It is.
You got a loud one.
Hello?
Hit it.
I can speak loudly.
Yeah.
What is someone really saying when they tell someone to get over it? They're saying, please stop grieving. I'm starting to feel my grief in your presence, and I don't want to feel my grief. It may not be conscious, but that's what they're really saying. Please stop feeling uncomfortable. So just invite them. As I said earlier, this is what's true for you, and they're free to come and go as they please. We don't have to take care of everyone all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think she was first in that. Mm-hmm.
My husband and I were at a funeral of a lovely Jewish man. And part of the ceremony at the grave site was to pin pieces of cloth on his close relatives. And the rabbi went and he pinned these little pieces of cloth on them. And then he said, this is the time for grief right now. And he went and he symbolically ripped the pieces off, you know, the suits and the dresses like this, and went down like that. And he says, in the Old Testament says, you know, rend your garments.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that really struck me.
The wailing wall comes to mind.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of grief.
Yeah. To encourage it. The discussion of cultural differences is immense. Different cultures. I was raised in an Italian family, so I could tell you stories.
You know, the comment about people telling you to get over it, you may tell yourself that. My wife died 4 years ago, and I wanted it to be over in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't over in a year. It's been 4 years now, and I'm just now really coming out of it. One of my hobbies was canning jams and jellies and fruits and vegetables. I haven't done that since she died until last week.
Oh.
So, you know.
It's not unusual.
Yeah, I realized that, but I found myself telling myself I should be getting over this, you know. I want to move on, and, you know, so don't beat yourself up that way.
Right, right. And you know, there's a, I don't know if this is helpful or whether, I think for some people it's really helpful and for others it's not. But in Europe, they did this huge study on widows and widowers, and they found that, who have lost their spouse, and they found that for 1 year, they did a formula, for 1 year, if you're married, period, in a relationship, expect to grieve for a year. For every 5 years after that, expect to grieve for another year.
Every 5 years of marriage translates to another year of grief. Do the math.
We were only married a little less than 4 years.
It's just a formula, you know. It's like it takes a lot to work through your attachments to these people. I mean, they're like your your other half, you know, and to come back to yourself. This is part of the transformation. You come back to yourself and you become more whole as an individual. You become more centered. You become more authentic.
I wrote a poem about the hole in my heart after she left. The process of healing. Mm-hmm.
And may I encourage you, if the tears come, let them come.
Oh, I cry like hell.
I meant now.
Oh, I still do.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
When my mother died, she was in a nursing home back then, and it was about 10 o'clock in the morning that they were wheeling her body down the hall on a gurney, and there was a gentleman, an elderly gentleman, sitting in a wheelchair, and as she was wheeled by, he said to me, "We're all like falling leaves." Mm-hmm. And I've never forgotten that, and thought how the people that are left behind in the home see, one by one, people being healed out. Mm-hmm. And who's next, you know. Mm-hmm. You're really touched, man. Never forget one.
Mm-hmm. I really appreciate that. And one of the things in our book, we talk about not only the grieving process, but also the process of dying, too. And what that's about, and to remember that we are all dying. We're all in two ways. When we're dying, we're grieving. We're grieving everything that we have had in this world, on this earth. We're losing everything,
including our body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and when we're grieving, we're dying. We're dying to the way things were. So they go hand in hand, and to be able to work through both of those experiences.
Yes.
When I really appreciate you talking about this, especially the grieving part, because I had some serious surgery earlier in my life, and I realized I was furious. I mean, I hated everybody afterwards because I felt fine before the surgery.
Love the honesty in this room.
I hated my parents, the doctor. I didn't hate my husband, but I hated everybody. And now, you know, I realize that this is grief. But no one told you that. Mm-hmm. You know, they just said, get over it. And now my mother is losing her body. You know, I mean, she's losing the ability to use the body as she did. And she's very angry. And I'm beginning to understand what that is, that it's the grieving. And you know, she knows she's not going to be able to take care of her house much longer. And my brother and I are trying to interfere. and I, you know, we have to let go of that. It's
the
pain stuff.
Isn't it beautiful, though? You have that experience, you've gotten through it, and you're able to have the wisdom that comes from that.
Yes.
To be able to touch other people and have compassion for them.
Becoming a teacher yourself.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
If I may say it, anger in this context, anger is a form of denial.
Uh-huh.
And denial is okay. The extent we want someone to come out of denial, Mary referred to it earlier, speaks about our discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
Or you want someone to cheer up because they're depressed. Well, in God's universe, it may be helpful for that person to be withdrawn emotionally for a while. They're doing inner work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our discomfort with their depression. Our fear comes up. Like if it's our spouse, oh my God, my spouse is becoming chronically depressed. Please cheer up. We got to get him help, her help, you know. Well, there is a point where I think medication is helpful and certainly professional counseling. But so many times with what is called natural depression that comes with grieving, it's part of the process. It's just part of, even if it lasts years, it's still part, it's natural in that sense, part of the process. I think back.
I found that my relationship, you know, since my husband died, well, I don't have to protect people from his anger, or I don't have to get him to do something, and I'm starting to behave sometimes the way he did. I'm thinking, wow.
You know, it's interesting. That's natural. After somebody dies, oftentimes we take on their personality.
Mm-hmm.
My son, Greg, took on my son Ted's personality, wore his clothes, you know, was with his friends, and he behaved in a very different way for about 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And this is very common. So, yeah, maybe what you're doing.
I think the hand in the back was next, and then this one.
Well, my husband died when I was 29, and I was so angry. I was angry at my sister, my good friends. I was angry at God. I was angry at everybody because they couldn't fix me. You know, I had lost my identity. I was so young. My identity was wrapped up in my husband. And I lost that too. So I was actually angry at my husband who passed away. And so I had to come full circle and I had to find myself again.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing that, I realized how precious life is.
Oh.
And every moment counts.
Mm-hmm.
And we can't let it waste. We have to live in the moment.
True wisdom.
Yeah.
And how hard it is to live in the moment, because our minds have these habits. They're so deeply grooved of reacting emotionally or looking to the past or worrying about the future. It's hard to keep coming here.
Yeah,
thank you.
I had an experience I'd like to share that I visit a certain amount of dying people over the past years, and one of my best friends was in the hospital and he was obviously dying. But he really didn't want to dialogue with me or anybody that came to see him. And I learned that maybe a little bit the hard way. But I went there and I just sat there.
Mm-hmm.
And then his wife said to me after he died that he really liked you being there.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times when you go in to see somebody who's dying, you don't have to say anything. Just be there.
Yeah.
Being rather than doing.
So true. That is so true. And again, I tell a very similar story. In the book, and not to underestimate the power of your presence.
Of your presence.
You know, it's so important. If you can, especially if you can come from that place of a loving presence, a caring presence, and people need that, especially when they're depressed. I tell a story about how this man, I had worked with him for several months, and I walk into his room and he's not saying anything, which is very unusual. And I said to him, I said, Bob, you want me to leave? He says, no, please stay.
Yeah.
And he didn't say a word. And I just sat there and meditated. It's just really important.
I wasn't that insightful. The guy didn't like my lousy joke.
You can even do that on the telephone. I used to sit with my friend who was in another, long way away. And I just sit there.
You learn you don't have to fix anything.
You don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just
for
you. Really like it.
Yeah.
This issue.
Long term.
Is there a question?
It's back there.
No, you couldn't hear it in the beginning, but then he started speaking up. So.
Okay. Yeah, the microphone is unreliable. Yeah.
David Rico has written a book called The Five Things We Cannot Change.
Mm-hmm.
And number one is that all things change and come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that reading is a life skill. And maybe they ought to teach this in high school.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going to use it the rest of your life.
Because life has changed.
All things change and come to an end.
So loss is inherent in life.
Mm-hmm.
It's how we respond to that loss.
Right.
That's the issue. I love, just one thought, there's one quote I'd like to pass along to you from a great yoga teacher, Swami Muktananda. He once said, the wise man gets angry, we're talking about angry, anger, the wise man gets angry and is joyful the next moment. The fool gets angry and takes it to his grave.
Right.
Mm. Isn't that beautiful?
Mm-hmm.
So anger isn't the problem. It's how we're with our feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It's where, to me, the spiritual, practical spiritual wisdom lies.
Bring awareness to it.
Mm. Instead of saying, I shouldn't be this, or I should be more that, and we all have those voices.
Can you repeat that again?
Sure. The wise man gets angry and is joyful the next moment. Number 4 on that list.
Mm-hmm.
The fool gets angry and takes it to his grave. Look at our language. We talk about holding a grudge.
Mm-hmm.
It's like our mind has fingers. We lock on. But it's not just painful things. We do that. What is infatuation with someone? We lock on.
Mm-hmm.
I love you, unless, as long as you do this and this and this, I love you, but honey, you do that. Right? Well, it's human, it's fine, but it's not love.
And you take that, though. You take that infatuation and look at that. It goes in many different ways. Isn't that often part of projection? We see that the beauty in somebody else and we fall in love with the other
person.
Great
phrase.
And then it's a matter of starting to bring it back and to realize that that is within us. And that's the beauty also of when somebody we love and our attitude dies, we can take our projection back and realize that we are, there is a center that God is the connection and it goes all the way through us.
It's painful grace, isn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're forced to take it back.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I had to keep this segment on death and dying to some high school students at one time.
Wonderful.
And one of the things I said, and I don't remember the original author, but it was the idea that from birth to life, that when you are born, you start dying.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, the way you live is the way you are going to die. So therefore, in the thought always is the thought that there's going to be an end. And so, live it well.
The Buddha advised his disciples to live with death on their shoulders, which at first sounds, gee, how depressing.
Mm-hmm.
Why would he tell his disciples that?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
yeah,
the key to living fully.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very, very important. And Christine Longacre talks about how a person dies and what they go through.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting. Again, it's in our book. And I recommend when anyone reads our book that they take that in and look at that as we are right in this moment and how we are living and how to get through life. And it just speeded up around the time of death.
Mm-hmm.
But it's these various points that we can look at and work with today so that when we do have a terminal illness, it's not as difficult to go through that.
Yeah. Ron, I'm going to switch gears a little here, and I know you kind of wanted to avoid this section of the chapters that you did, but I'd like you to make some statement about near-death experience, and I know you're saying it's so broad that it would take a whole course.
Sure, no,
but
I'd be happy to.
Did what she's writing here about the common experience and all near-death experiences resonate with your own work with near-death experience, or... what do you think is happening there?
Okay.
You
huh?
You were.
Yeah. I had a near-death experience. When I was 27, I was nearly killed in an accident. And I spent 4.5 months in a body cast. I had 6 operations in 6 months. My mother had a severe postmenopausal depression was how it was diagnosed in those days. The following severe concussion, I lost my short-term memory. In the middle of all of that, I had this experience that I'll address in a moment. But just to tell you the context, the following spring, my father-in-law died of cancer, and then the following May, my mother took her own life. So this was a very intense time And we have our first of our three children were born in the middle of this. So it was a very intense time. I appreciate your asking. Actually, I for receptive folks, I find it helpful to talk about if it's helpful to you. The last thing I remember was being on the highway at a certain place north of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is where we were living then. And the way we're talking now, the next thing I knew, it was over 6 weeks later, July 26, 6 weeks later. And all I can remember in between was a moment where, it feels like a moment, because I can't say it was hours. There was no linear time to this. I remember being above my body in the hospital room, looking down at myself in a full body cast, all tied up to IVs and all of this. And my mother, who was still alive at that point, and my father had flown in from the East Coast, relatively from New Jersey to Pittsburgh. And Valerie, my wife, was 7 months pregnant. She was standing there, and they were all looking at that body. And the place I was in, I'll just describe it to you. It's very consistent with what she says in this chapter. The first word is peaceful. It was just calm. It was, there was no emotional reactivity. It wasn't like cold, no emotion. It was peaceful, no emotion. Content. And I kept trying to get their attention. Like, I'm not over there, I'm over here. And there was nothing I could do. They would not turn around. But I could feel them wanting me back there. And I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to go back. Because where I was pretty nice. And I remember saying, oh, well, you'll see. And I turned to leave. And I came into the presence of a person that I had known in my life and respected, who had died 3 years previously. And he said to me, I said, I was so happy to see him, I called him by name, and he said, I'm sorry, you have to go back. And I argued with him, which is why I don't equate near-death experiences with pure spiritual experiences, because there was still personality and ego in this. It's like a foot, for me, it was like a foot in both worlds. And I argued with him, and he simply smiled and shook his head. He didn't say another word to me. And then I went through a series of experiences. I can describe them to you. You know how when you wake up in the morning sometimes and you're still half in your dream and half in the room, and for a moment you don't know where you are? It's like, am I at grandma's house? Am I at the motel on vacation? Where am I? That was the feeling. I went from like feeling everywhere to feeling somewhere. It was like a somewhereness feeling. I don't know how else to describe that. There was no body sensation. I felt very cold. Like, you know how when you have the flu sometimes and you get chills and there's not enough blankets? It was an intense experience of that. Coldness. I remember feeling rocked, like I was in a boat. I was later told that was, I became aware of my breath again. I later had a teacher share with me that the experiences I had were well known in their particular spiritual tradition. I knew none of that. And Raymond Moody's book hadn't even been published or written yet, so I had no reference for this. So we come back into this world, we identify with our breathing, we identify with the element of heat and cold, and it was only, I remember feeling very thirsty, I remember that, I can tell you that. And only then did I feel like I was back. And that's when the pain started. These waves of pain, because I had broken like 8 or 9 bones in my body, and I was in a body cast, as I said, for a long time. And now please hear this, there's a story that goes with this. Before I opened my eyes, I remember clearly saying to myself, damn, I'm being honest with you. I didn't want to come back. I wanted to be with him. But the moment I opened my eyes and my wife was looking right at me, and she later told me that was the time they weren't sure I was going to live or die.
Mm-hmm.
And I can tell you, I made a choice to leave.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't like I want to die, or it wasn't psychological.
Mm-hmm.
It was something deeper that knew I could be there or here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in me now. It never leaves,
mm-hmm.
that feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I ask you to think of powerful, transformative times in your life where you know you're different, even if you can't articulate it, you've been through something,
mm-hmm.
and you're different. That's how I feel. It's like, it's okay to have a body. This may sound odd. It's okay, you know. It's a pain sometimes. I enjoy it other times, and it's like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
But it's only a part of who we are. So,
great. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. May I share one last thing
to
finish?
Okay.
I see the time. I wanted to say earlier, and we had questions about anger.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to share with you something that Mary and I have discovered and haven't had a chance to say it, but when I hear your interest, I wanted to share it with you. No one can make you feel anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a myth. This myth in America, I call it the M word. You made me. You made me angry. You made me jealous. You made me sad. It's nonsense.
Made me happy.
You made me happy. I can only be happy with you, my love. Is there a part of you when someone says that that goes, oh, please? Right? It's another form of denial to believe that. And most of us believe it. And if somebody starts questioning it, we try to convince them they're wrong. Oh no, he may. I would be angry if he did that to me, right? We put our hand on our hips, right? We have a friend who calls it a spiritual insanity plea to blame anyone else for your feelings. Your birthright is joy, peace, contentment, inspiration. They're not judging the feelings. They're fine to have them, but don't give your power away. You have many options in any moment. Well, sorry if I opened a can of worms.
No, that's fine. Just has to be the last very
long. Also, don't blame yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Which is what guilt is, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Mm-hmm.
Huh? It's your fault, it's my fault.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's fault, it's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a choice of how to feel about it, how you feel. So thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank Ron and Mary for coming and sharing.